Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Cruz and Kasich are down for the count, but Hunter and Ellis are just getting warmed up. It's time for our conversation with the Dakota Political Junkies. John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. John Hunter joins us from Madison. John, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Lori. Glad to be here.
And Jonathan Ellis joins us from Sioux Falls. Jonathan, thanks for showing up as well.
Hey, glad to be here, Lori.
Let's start with Donald Trump and the sort of challenges that his inevitable nomination brings for South Dakota Republicans. John Hunter, do you want to start us off on that topic?
Sure. Yeah, it'll be an interesting thing. And I've been thinking about this in just a little bit today in preparation, how, you know, we've probably talked more primary politics this year than any other that I remember, with so many Republican candidates and kind of working our way through that and so forth. And South Dakota kind of being on the sidelines for this whole thing, and it appears as though our primary votes won't matter. But nevertheless, it feels as though certainly the closeness of Iowa and all the national attention, I think South Dakota Republicans are well aware of what's going on, and now they have a decision to make as to whether they want to support the nominee or not support the nominee. So I think it's been quite a campaign season for South Dakota Republicans.
What are some of the risks of really embracing him and saying we support the Republican nominee going forward, Jonathan?
Well, he's obviously been very controversial. He's alienated a lot of people, especially women, by some of the statements he's made. You know, he's unorthodox for a lot of Republicans, who, especially on issues, for example, on trade issues. He sort of evokes the Pat Buchanan protectionist aspect, and that's anathema to a lot of free trade Republicans. And you find a lot of free trade Republicans in South Dakota because, being an agriculture state, I think a lot of Republicans recognize the importance of free trade here. So, you know, there's that issue. I mean, there will be many Republicans in this state who just simply will not go for Donald Trump. And it's hard to see how all this plays out necessarily, but, you know, this potentially, I mean, if Hillary Clinton's a nominee, you recall that Bill Clinton did pretty well in this state, and Bill Clinton actually has kind of an affinity for South Dakota. You know, it's conceivable that Hillary Clinton could win this state. I mean, that's how drastic I think that this is a nomination for that Trump winning the nomination is going to be.
John, we've talked a lot on this show and others about John Thune as a potential vice presidential candidate. It's sort of an evergreen topic. Does he even want that kind of nod of approval from Donald Trump?
No. I mean, if you're asking me, no, I don't think so. I don't think John considers himself a possibility for that. I think I just found it funny when, of course, Chris Christie dropped out. He, I think, wanted exactly that. I think he was trying to set himself up as to be the vice presidential. Now, they're both two guys, kind of New York, New Jersey kinds of things, both can be speakers of uncommon insults at different times. So I think Trump would select someone else. But, yeah, I don't think it'll be John Thune.
We have talked a lot about the Republican Party in general, but the Democrats aren't necessarily safe from this sort of a candidate coming in, an insurgent candidate, if you will. Are they? Is there something fundamentally different about the Republican Party than the Democrats right now at this time, Jonathan?
Well, I mean, Bernie Sanders is sort of an outsider candidate, and that race, of course, continues. You know, the Democrats have a different way of, you know, a different process in terms of how they nominate, you know, their presidential candidate. They have superdelegates, which comprise a fairly large bulk of elected Democrats, sort of establishment Democrats. So, you know, just by the very nature of how they nominate a presidential candidate, they're less likely to have somebody sort of take over the party in a way that sort of Donald Trump has.
A Kanye West for No, that's not going to happen. I think he was throwing his hat in the ring kind of early, so you just can't quite tell which celebrity is going to come out next, I'm afraid. Let's go to a micro level now. We've talked about the nation. Let's talk about the city of Hartford, kind of having a lot of shakeups in their city council. Now their mayor has resigned. Jonathan Ellis, do you want to start with an overview of what's been happening in Hartford since November?
Oh, boy. There's been a lot going on in Hartford. Yeah, you've had, you had a faction on the city council, and they voted to do away with sort of the economic development position. Then you had, you know, some reaction to that. You had an attempt to recall the mayor, I think, and some others, at least another city council member. You had, you had this group called Growing Hartford, and then you had a city councilor who sort of read an email saying he got an email from a member of the group, and turned out that was falsified email, that he'd actually made it up himself. And so it is just a lot of tumult going on in Hartford. And so he saw some new city councilors elected, and then last night, the mayor decided to resign and kind of, in his words, I guess, try to put an end to some of the controversy that's been going on. But yeah, it's been, if you live in Hartford, there's been a lot going on since last fall.
And what kind of impact is that having on the people of Hartford? John Hunter, you want to talk about what that kind of shakeup can have on a smaller community like that?
It's a great question, and I think that's undecided yet. The mayor certainly believes that it's kind of been harmful to Hartford, and to see the city name of Hartford in the newspapers every day, and or at least frequently, about all this controversy. But I don't think it's been necessarily a bad thing. I think you do see more engagement, and one of the opponents of the mayor said that more people are engaged. Certainly they are taking a closer look at their own government than normally would be in city, small-town municipalities. You know, most of them in South Dakota, comprise of, in small towns, sometimes don't even have elections because they won't have enough candidates to do this. It's like, who can we get to serve? And, you know, the mayor's job pays $500 a year, plus $50 a meeting in Hartford, less so for counselors. So they're, by and large, kind of volunteer positions. And so in this case where you do, you know, they had enough counselors resigned for a moment, they couldn't conduct city business because they didn't have a quorum, and then you get some new ones and so forth. But on the other hand, if you talk about civic engagement, if you get talk about citizens kind of getting involved and understanding, and frankly, if they don't like the things that the council is doing, they should present themselves and take action and go to the ballot box and remove them. And so I think it's overall, it may have been a kind of a painful process to go through, but I sure like to see all that civic engagement in Hartford.
Jonathan, the whole email thing, when we talk about civic engagement, we're also talking about holding people accountable. So explain to me what happened with the email and sort of there being an integrity issue there. And how was he sort of called out on that?
Well, some of he took an email that he'd received from a member of the group and actually spiced it up.
And now we're not talking about the mayor now, right? Who are we talking about?
This was one of the city councilmen.
Councilman. Okay, go ahead, please.
Sort of added some language to the email, you know, saying that he directed insults to himself and I believe his family, so contrived this email. And I mean, it actually, the Minnehaha County Sheriff's Office and the state's attorney's office looked at whether or not there had been, anything criminal. In the end, they declined to press charges, and the council member owned up to the fact that he had done this. And so that sort of satisfied, I think, the people growing Hartford. But, as John said, I mean, it really intensified the civic engagement in that community. And, Hartford's not a big place. And so to have a controversy like this, I mean, you're talking about pitting neighbor against neighbor in some respect.
What's the media's role been in this as far as, open meetings and showing up for council meetings? You know, how has the Argus Leader been sort of chasing this down?
Yeah, we've had reporters, fairly consistently following this for several months and reporting on the updates. And keep in mind, I mean, this also sparked some legislation in Pierre regarding how recalls are conducted and things of that nature. So I mean, it's reached beyond the borders of just Hartford.
John Hunter, what happens next for a city like Hartford? What do they do to shake this off and form a solid city government and move forward?
Well, I think the ballot box is the best place to do those kinds of things. And if you can get good candidates, and I have every indication that they are good candidates. But I want to backpedal to your previous question, at least a little bit, as to how they move forward, and that is openness in government. And so, I can't stress enough how that contributes to good local effective government. And some people aren't used to that, right? If you're in private business, businesses are not governments. Businesses are owned by people or corporations or whatever, and governments are of the people, and so they belong to the people. These are public servants, and so there is a growing sense of that in South Dakota, where you have a presumption of openness. This is not something to hide. And so anywhere from documents to minutes to emails to whatever, the more open this government can be in the future will lend credibility to that. Every time a deal is sealed behind closed doors, either under the guise of an executive session or at a coffee shop somewhere out of the light of day, it detracts from that effective government. And so I'm hoping that they will understand that, the new councilors and the new mayor, which will come in eventually, that the more open the government, the more trustworthy, the more credibility that builds, and that's, I think, their path to a new, brighter day.
Jonathan Ellis, John just said some examples of open government. Do you want to add to that list at all of things that citizens should expect and require in regards to openness from their leaders?
Well, John's right. I mean, openness is very important. So that includes having open meetings. That includes being very transparent about business dealings. That includes being transparent about your budgeting process, which is really, well, at the end of the day, citizens want to know that their tax money is being spent wisely. And so, you know, all of those, being above board on those things are very important in order to, for the people to have trust in their local governments.
Hmm. Let's go and talk about this Department of Justice investigation now, kind of switching gears, state politics a little bit. Jonathan, you've written about this in the Argus, so let's start with you. Explain to me what the heck is going on with the federal lawsuit.
Well, there's the Americans with Disabilities Act, and there's a Supreme Court ruling from 1999 that basically said that, you know, people who have disabilities can't be segregated, you know, from the rest of the community. And the Department of Justice began investigating the state in 2014, arguing with the assumption that the state was sort of violating that segregation issue by taking people, some disabled adults, some of them senior citizens, some of them younger, and sort of housing them in nursing homes. And that's contrary to what, you know, the federal government has been trying to get states to more develop care alternatives in which people are left in their communities, and preferably, I think, for a lot of, if possible, for people to be left in their homes and to have home health care. In South Dakota, I mean, I've written about this almost for a decade. South Dakota has really lagged the rest of the nation with regard to home health care options, community-based health care options. And while the state has been, you know, enacting some reforms and trying to improve upon that, that was not aggressive enough for the Department of Justice. So it's sort of a major shot across the bow to the state of South Dakota that they'd better get moving on this issue faster, or they're going to face a potential lawsuit from the feds.
John Hunter, why is the state involved in putting people in nursing homes in the first place? Can you just lay that out for me?
Sure, and I think Jonathan has done a nice reporting job of this. I think just to read that Department of Justice document deserves, you take them out to lunch or something.
How many pages was it, Jonathan?
I was like, it was 35 pages.
35. Easy to read.
It seems longer.
All right, so, go ahead, John.
Anyway, this is by and large a Medicaid issue, and so state does have certain responsibilities for people with disabilities, and so there is a, I think in many, now Madison may be an atypical community that has both nursing home facilities and disabled person facilities, and so We're acutely aware of the, I think, of the benefits that the legislation, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the second title of that, where you engage people back in the community and live independently and so forth. And so it does require a shift, by and large, of funding from one to another, although I think many people argue that kind of the home-based kind of integrated with the community care can be a lot less expensive to that. Mm-hmm. And kind of overriding this thing, or not overriding, but as part of that, you've got the moratorium on nursing home beds in South Dakota, where you can't build any more of those. And so, but they do, I think, for the sake of the nursing homes and keep them in operating, try to keep them full. That's a critical part, I think, of making these nursing homes viable in the long term. So you've got a lot of different moving parts, and I think that it appears to me from reading that document, or at least part of it, not the Jonathan Ellis version, but the summary page, is that the state, I think, would like to move in that direction too. I think they were plenty cooperative with the Department of Justice in this investigation. They're going to look at that. I think they probably, would admit that they're not moving fast enough to get toward that end. So I don't see a really an angry, bitter thing between the federal government and the state, but there may be some prodding in order to get to where the feds would like to go.
Jonathan, how fast does the state have to move if we're moving too slowly? How, what are those first steps to sort of pick up the pace and show good faith in solving the problem?
That's a good question. I don't know that I have the answer to that. I do know that some of the recommendations or suggestions that the Department of Justice made would be fairly alien, I think, to some people in South Dakota. And one of those, one of the suggestions that, or one of the excuses I think South Dakota's had for many years is that we don't necessarily have a good workforce to provide home health care, that kind of thing. And the Department of Justice suggested that, well, why don't you pay family members to provide home health care, which to a lot of people in South Dakota would seem very odd. I mean, that's the federal government, or the state in this case, and the federal government paying family members to help care for another family member just does not, I don't know that would sit well with a lot of people. So there's some interesting things in there that sort of seem to maybe conflict with South Dakota cultural self-reliance. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
Jonathan Ellis is a reporter and columnist with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks, Lori.
And John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks, Lori. Have a great day.
You too.